Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome to the Monday edition of the Three Martini Lunch along with Jim Garrity of NationalReview.com. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America, and Jim got to play the role of, I don't know if it was Siskel or Ebert or Roper, maybe all three combined. And late last week, he got a chance to take a look at a new documentary, I think is probably the best way to look at it, about the political rise of Sarah Palin to where she is now. If you go to NationalReview.com, you can see his review of that film very prominently displayed. And Jim, for those who may not have a chance to get to the review in print real quickly, what came home most to you as you watch this film? What do you take away from it most?
We've all probably seen at least one political documentary before, and I kind of went into this kind of expecting something kind of cookie cutter. I knew this was being done by a filmmaker, Stephen Bannon, who was very friendly to Palin. He emphasizes she had no editorial control. Sarah Pack had reached out to him and said, we want you to do a 20 to 30 minute documentary. And he said, you know, I don't want to do that, but I do want to do a movie. Just give me permission to do it. Help me get in touch with some folks in Alaska, and I want to show you what I can do. And the end result is a documentary called The Undefeated, which, you know, at first glance looks like a very ironic title about Sarah Palin, but in fact makes a very persuasive case that just as 300 is not about the defeat of Leonidas, that, you know, the ultimate victory of the ideas that someone stands for. I was blown away by it, because obviously there were a couple problems here and there, but this is a much more interesting, much more artistic, and I'd say much more gripping documentary than a lot of people would say, oh, it's a biopic about Sarah Palin. First of all, the visual style is very much fitting, I would say, for the MTV generation. But Greg, you're younger than I am. Do kids even watch MTV anymore? It's not, all like spooky and reality shows and stuff.
Yeah, pretty much. There's no music left there anymore.
My frame of reference for this. So it is very much, but it fits well, the visual style with quick cuts and lots of funny little uses of stock footage and historical footage and all kinds of things. It's kind of fascinating that apparently Ed Morrissey of Hot Air had a real problem with it. He loved the subject material. He loved the message, but he thought the visual style was not his cup of tea. So it'll be very interesting to see whether there's this, the medium and the message. This is perhaps what worked most for me. And I think the other thing which kind of comes out of me is that, Greg, if you'll let me channel my inner film geek for a few minutes here. I know people are familiar with Joseph Campbell's The Hero's Journey or Hero with a Thousand Faces. And what Joseph Campbell did is very influential on George Lucas when he was creating the Star Wars trilogy, is this idea that you look at every great myth and legend from every culture all around the globe, and they all have certain similar characteristics and similar story parts. Not every one of them has the exact same thing, but usually your heroes start from some sort of humble beginning, some sort of beginning in which they would not be perceived to be heroic. And then at some point there's a call to adventure. Someone either, you know, encourages them to go out and do something that is out of the ordinary. Usually it's a quest of some kind. And then they hit obstacles and they hit setbacks and they end up getting bruised. And sometimes there's some sort of learning experience that comes out of this. And then they end up triumphing in the end from, you know, looking into themselves and finding this inner strength. And all of these kind of story beats that you've seen in Rocky, basically almost every great Hollywood story of a underdog hero overcoming the odds. In the language of film, this is what Ben's doing with this movie. It's a much more interesting movie as a movie than you might have expected of, oh, here comes another documentary saying hooray for Sarah Palin. That aspect angle appealed to me to a great deal. I think Sarah Palin fans will adore this movie. I think the people who hate her will break out in hives, or perhaps their heads will explode watching this. I think it could be a powerful political argument if you can get people to watch it. I'm not sure if there are that many undecided folks on Sarah Palin out there. But look, I think in terms of how our politics are discussed, this is a really fascinating contribution to what's probably going to be a very contentious argument about Sarah Palin in the year to come.
Yeah, I'm waiting for strong reviews from the Hardball panel. I'm sure Howard Feynman and Chris Matthews and Eugene Robinson will love it. Jim, real quickly, one of the things that you put in your review that I thought was most intriguing is that the documentary will seem incomplete without a presidential run, and that may strike a lot of conservatives as good news, others perhaps not so good, depending on whether or not they think she can win a general election. What's your sense? Do you think this is essentially a precursor to her throwing her hat in the ring?
Well, it ends with Sarah Palin at the tax day rally in Wisconsin earlier this year in April, and it ends with her saying, President Obama, game on, which is something she said, simply talking about this ideological fight between big government and liberalism and conservatism. But certainly, that certainly sounds like I'm ready to take you on. Then the other thing which they told me at the screening Friday was that, Greg, it's going to debut in New Hampshire, Iowa, South Carolina, and Nevada.
Just randomly.
What do those states have in common? So obviously, we don't know Palin's in until she says so officially. But, you know, she probably, you know, she saw the film. She said it blew her away. She didn't say, don't end it, making it look like I'm going to run. So certainly this looks like the preview of the Palin presidential campaign. And you'd like to think that if she didn't want to run, at some point she would have said, hey, let's not end it that way. Let's not lead everybody on. But, you know, I guess with Sarah Palin, you never really know until the call is made.
Exactly. On to martini number two now, and this one takes us back overseas. And, of course, President Obama said in late 2009 that he was going to dramatically ramp up the presence of U.S. forces in Afghanistan and then, of course, begin bringing them home in the summer of 2011. And, well, the official date is July 2011, and obviously we're less than a month away from that now. And now we're hearing reports, Jim, that the president believes that since bin Laden is dead and as a result of some other factors, that he can start ramping down the troop withdrawals much faster than we originally expected. You know, he was the one who just about a month ago said this doesn't end the war and there's still a lot of work to be done. And amazingly, a month later, he seems to have changed his tune.
You may have heard me say this once or twice, Greg, that every statement from Barack Obama comes with an expiration date, all of them. So they'd be applied. The only good news for us is that if, heaven forbid, things get worse in Afghanistan, this statement, too, will have an expiration date and you can send in more troops if necessary. Greg, as time goes by in Afghanistan, I find myself wanting to have a higher caliber of this kind of debate because there's a part of me that feels like, well, it's been almost 10 years in Afghanistan. Have we done everything we can do? I understand people, all the complaints of the folks who kind of say like, all right, we spent a lot of time there. It's time for the Afghanis to start taking on their own. Part of the problem is Karzai and the government just is rampant corruption over there. If we don't have a serious partner in this effort, we're never going to be able to do this on our own. All of that makes a lot of sense to me. My only fear is that if we pull out, the Taliban takes over and you know, God forbid, Al-Qaeda sets up shop there again, we're right back where we began. So I'm kind of curious. I'd like to have a really constructive debate about what we've done, what can conceivably be done, and what else is just kind of we're subject to events. It depends on conditions on the ground. I guess that, you know, I think you're starting, you might, this as a presidential campaign moves forward, I think you might see some conservatives, or I should say some Republicans. And I think that Utah Governor John Huntsman is kind of taking this theme of, you know what, it's time to reevaluate our overseas commitments. And I have no problem with, you know, evaluation. Let's take a look at how things are in Afghanistan. But I'm not quite convinced that we can pull out without any bad consequences, at least not yet. So we'll see how this shakes out. I expect this to be a very hot topic as the summer continues.
No, most certainly will be. Another topic that won't go away, much to the chagrin of New York Congressman Anthony Weiner, D. New York 9, is, of course, this Twitter situation that sprung up just at the start of Memorial Day weekend. He basically poured the gasoline on it by doing a million interviews about it last week. And it seemed to be slightly dying down, but enter one Andrew Breitbart, the man who has disseminated these Acorn videos, Planned Parenthood videos, and NPR videos, video by video, and now he's apparently been in contact with another woman via Twitter who has gotten a lot of pictures from Anthony Weiner, some of which Breitbart says he can't even put online. So, but apparently it looks like this story is anything but going away quickly.
The idea that there might be other women out there who've had these types of exchanges with Weiner doesn't seem like the most shocking development in a circumstance like this. If he really was the type of person to send those kind of pictures out to attractive young women on his Twitter feed, the idea of this being a one-off doesn't seem terribly plausible. We will see how this shakes out. If you're on the right, I can't tell whether you want this story to go on forever, that every single day, the one of the dominant political stories is a once allegedly rising star in New York Democratic politics imploding, looking stupid, sounding stupid, and behaving as if he thinks everyone else around him is stupid. And I think that over time, that's incredible. It's kind of interesting to see the Democrats not rushing to his aid. At some point, somebody's going to go to him and say, this story has to end. And that, I think the only way this really does end is if he resigns his seat and heads off into a lucrative lobbying career somewhere. And, tries to make a comeback someday as an elder statesman or something. It's beyond embarrassing now. I think the question is, when does it turn into an embarrassment for the party?
Yeah, that's exactly right. Although, as we've mentioned before, the two parties have very different ideas about how to handle these things. Of course, Christopher Lee was gone without even a statement. Mark Foley was gone without a statement. And Barney Frank's still in Congress. So go figure out exactly what the Democratic strategy might be on this one. But we'll find out. Jim, have a great day. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
Looking forward to it. See you tomorrow, Greg.
Jim Garrity of NationalReview.com. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Please join us Tuesday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.